because that was quite interesting.
Graham Allen, Reel 3. So if we now talk about the Atlantic Charter.
Yes. One rather glamorous episode was that, I think it was just before, about the middle of 1940, the Prince of Wales was selected by Churchill because the Prince of Wales was really one of Churchill's favourite ships, unfortunately. It was selected by Churchill to carry him and a lot of top brass across the Atlantic to meet Roosevelt at Placentia Harbour in Newfoundland. This required a great deal of reorganization in the ship, because all the not only did Churchill come with his staff, but he also brought the head of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and their hangers-on too, and also General Professor Charbel was also there. So the whole ship was really turned upside down to make room for these people, and a lot of young officers were really miffed to be turned out of their cabins so that Field Marshal, somebody or other, could be there. Certainly Admiral Sir Dudley Pound came along, with who looked every inch an admiral, though, as we now know, he didn't have much between the ears. He had the most formidable eyebrows I've ever seen, no doubt that. And a great deal of gold braid all the way up his sleeve, of course. So on the quarterdeck, you'd have as we were going across the Atlantic of an evening, you'd have the whole of the top brass of the British Empire really strolling up and down. A really fine a target for any German submarine, but we had good speed and an escort, and so that was all right.
What was daily life like on board while all these top brass were...
Well, the ship's routine carried on, of course, but you did find that if you were, say, on the bridge, on the watch, as midshipman of the watch, I'd find myself... you'd suddenly find that there'd be an influx of generals and air vice marshals and people. And, one just... they were quite interested, of course, what went on, and you'd explain what you were doing and everything. But it was... quite an interesting episode. Not the least of it was that they decided, Churchill decided, he wanted a war room. He wanted the same information available to him at sea as he had in London. So an office was given over to a war room, which meant a great big map on the wall of the whole of the North Atlantic. In fact, the whole of the world, including the North Atlantic, on which the pins were put to indicate the position of all HM ships, which, of course, one did not know. It was not something you normally knew. It was quite secret, in fact, where people were. And I was one of the midshipmen who was hauled out to operate this, to stick the pins in and to provide the information for when Churchill and others came to see it. And we also plotted, of course, convoys and German submarine packs, as far as we knew them. So that was really... And before doing so, we all had to be sworn to secrecy. Now, who we could have told, being stuck on a battleship in the middle of the Atlantic, goodness knows, but we were sworn to secrecy, not to talk about it. And that was really a most, interesting thing going on. I mean, to see all the inner workings of the imperial strategy, you might say.
Yeah. So Churchill came down to look at
it. Oh, Churchill came down.
Did he spend a lot of time there?
Not a lot. Well, he was all over the place. He had been given the Admiral's cabin, which is a big cabin aft, you see, under the quarterdeck. But at sea, of course, you have the propellers going, you see, and it vibrates a lot down there. He didn't like that at all. Anyway, he was away from the action. So he took over the Admiral's sea cabin, which was just two decks below the bridge. And so he was much nearer the action and could see what was going on and could pop on the bridge whenever he liked and interfere.
What was his demeanour when he came in his war room with you?
Oh, genial. Oh, very genial. He started enjoying himself, you see. He liked being at sea. And one day, he said that it was announced that Mr. Churchill was coming down to the gunroom to see the young midshipman. So we, of course, tidied the place up, you see, dusted off the best armchair, and down came Churchill with a couple of his sidekicks. Commander, there was a commander with him who used to, I forget his name now, doesn't matter. And he sat in the armchair, and he looked very genial, and he said, "Well, now, fire away, ask me any questions you like about the war." Right? So I was the senior midshipman, and I said, I thought I'd better lead off, so I said, at that time there was a lot of propaganda about bombing, you know. I said, is it much point in devoting so much effort into bombing the Germans, civilians, you know, when really it just, you might say, stimulates their to resist more? Oh, yes, it is, definitely, he said. Oh, I remember him saying, definitely worthwhile bombing them. This was total war now. Civilians are very much in the frame as targets, as much as any service people. And yes, it has to be done. And he was, of course, echoing the policies of Bomber Harris. But he's already been convinced that this was the right thing to do. But I think it was rather counterproductive myself. I mean, a vast effort put into bombing, which could have been turned into, you know, tanks and other ships and things. But however, I don't know. But certainly he was very, very gung-ho about that. And he thought that we should bomb the Germans as much as we possibly could. And other questions were asked, which I can't remember, but I remember that particular one. Of course, you didn't argue. You didn't say, "But sir," you couldn't. You just had to say, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir." You see, and be quiet, because you were.
What was Churchill's reputation with you at that time?
Oh, very good, very good. Oh yes, he was no doubt about that. Everybody was full of respect for his. He was the only man who could lead the country, mm-hmm. and he'd shown that in 1940, when he took, and he was definitely highly regarded by all personnel I've met, and but he was thoroughly very, very say genial. And at the end of it all, there was a he had a photograph taken of the whole ship's company with him in the front with the top brass, and with the 14-inch guns above, and I was a row of midshipmen in front, and I was right in front of Churchill, so you can see that in that book. I think it was Atlantic Meeting. So we got to, we eventually reached to Placentia Harbour, and came to anchor, or to buoy, I forget, and the President came on board a cruiser. I forget which one it was, but it was specially fitted out for him. It wasn't until then I realized how crippled Roosevelt was, you see. And actually, he came across on a gangway from the one ship to the other, where he was met by Churchill, and he managed to walk on his son's arm. His son was, I think, a lieutenant or in the U.S. Navy. As far as the length of the quarterdeck to some seats which were placed there. And it was then we realized that the man was, you know, very, very severely crippled. But nobody knew that at the time. There was sort of reception. There was the famous church service, which has been much photographed and recorded. And there was a reception. Oh, the other thing I remember asking Churchill about when we met him in the gunroom was the effect of the British war effort. I said, but if the Americans come into the war, and Churchill had been emphasizing how important it was to get them into the war, you see, if the Americans come into the war, surely all their war effort would, to show how, all their war effort would be devoted to their own purposes, and we would no longer get the benefit of Lend-Lease, they wouldn't have... But of course, that showed how little I knew about the American productivity. I mean, Churchill was quite confident, oh no, they can supply themselves and the rest of the world and Britain with armaments and, you know, without any trouble at all. Because, I mean, but I didn't, that being, you know, 19-year-old, I didn't realize what the American economic power was. So that was Churchill's major objective there, was to gradually, you know, persuade Roosevelt into the war. But of course, I think Roosevelt needed no persuading. It was, he just had to carry Congress and the people with him.
It's amazing that Churchill was quite concerned about what the midshipmen thought of him. He would take the trouble to go and meet them and
Well, he'd had you know, the same sort of session, I think, with the officers in the wardroom, and he was obviously, you know, I think he took a broad view of all this, that these are the you know, these are young officers who are next generation, and I think he was very sort of open to this sort of thing. And of course he was relaxed, you see, being in his ship, and in a way, although he had the communication with back home, it was really a nice little trip for him, you see. Every evening, he was very keen on films, as we all know. Every evening, the wardroom would be turned round, and the screen would be set up, and armchairs would be placed, and we'd have a film. Most of them were, of course, swashbucklers like Lady Hamilton and any of the and Fire Over England, all those films which showed Britain under stress but winning in the end. And we mids were invited up to the wardroom to watch, and you know, we carefully sat unobtrusively at the side. And but yes, I remember the film being finished, and Churchill would get up with his cigar and say, well, I think it was a splendid film, I do. And we'd all say, yes, sir. And so it was really a very, very interesting jaunt. And I met Mr. Roosevelt. All the officers were presented to Mr. Roosevelt, who said he was glad to meet us. And then we returned home. On the way back, keeping the plot, we realized that we were going to pass a convoy going from the States. We were going to overhaul a convoy. And it appeared that the chief of the naval staff, Admiral Sir Dudley Pound, Mr. Big in the Navy, the boss, had never seen a convoy. So the Prince of Wales and its escort were diverted to go down, to overtake the convoy, and to go down between the lines of these ships. And it must have been about 50 or 60 ships. Quite impressive. It was a fine day in the Middle Atlantic, and long lines of cargo ships chugging away. And down the middle of it steamed the Prince of Wales, doing about 20-odd knots, you see, with destroyers. Must have been very impressive. Churchill, of course, being a showman to the core, decided he wanted to be visible. Now, the Prince of Wales Bridge was a covered bridge, and so you had a sea there, roof to it. But in the roof was a trapdoor, So a ladder was hastily arranged, and a chair put up there, and Mr. Churchill climbed up onto the roof of the bridge, you see, and sat there and waved, you see, and a signal went up from the Prince of Wales to say, Churchill wishes you bon voyage, or something like that. And the message soon got across to all these ships. It was done with flags, of course. It's the quickest way to communicate, you see, with flags. Chaps pouring out of the stoke holes, where it was, to wave, you see, and Churchill, you know, unmistakable, with his cap on and his squat rig and his V-sign. It was, you know, quite an extraordinary opera. So the Admiral Sir Dudley Pound saw his convoy, and then we got back to, I think it must have been to Scarpa, I think, I can't remember, but anyway, that was a quite a pleasant sort of glamorous trip to be on.
Mm. Were you glad you were on the Prince of Wales?
Oh, yes. I mean, at the time, we all thought that, you know, in spite of a lot of teething troubles, we were on Britain's latest and greatest, and obviously couldn't be sunk, and we were going to do great things. Little did we know. And it was in October, I think it was, that we had our orders that we were going to the Far East. So we knew it was the Far East, and this was going to be Force Z. And we were going to meet up with Repulse and an aircraft carrier, which I think was the... we never met it, but I forget which one it was, but it's all recorded. So we went out to South Africa and drew in a Cape Town to refuel. Again, another little interesting episode. When we got to Cape Town, we went alongside. And great excitement amongst all the inhabitants of Cape Town who were pro-English, not so much amongst those who were pro-Boer. But we were told there'll be no shore leave until the bishop has been out to talk to us. So the bishop of Cape Town came aboard, and they cleared lower deck, and the bishop addressed the ship's company. And he said a lot of, you might say, well-meaning stuff about life in South Africa. But what he was really meaning, but he didn't actually say so, and I didn't, being innocent myself, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. What he was really meaning was, don't sleep with the black girls. This, you see, apartheid must be respected, so whatever you do, don't... But of course, I was innocent, I was, it never dawned on me this was what the real problem there was at all. I'm sure other people did, but the English inhabitants of Cape Town, the English people there, all rallied round, and there were fleets of cars and people to pick us up and take us off to picnics, officers and ratings, as you know, buses for the ratings as well. Anything, I suppose, to keep them busy, not that get mixed up with the blacks. It never struck me, of course, till later life that this was what it was all about. I mean, everybody was very generous. They all thought they were doing the right thing. It was all very charming and great fun, you know, but that was basically it, keep them out of mischief, you see. And so General Smuts also came to speak to the ship's company, and he was much more sober and said, you know, that there's a major problem ahead, and you've got a real, you know, this is a real crisis in the war, and you're going to be in the middle of it, and it's going to be tough. But even so, I think that only those who were much more senior realized how tough it was going to be, because we never, I mean, amongst the junior officers and among ratings, you see, nobody ever thought the Japanese were as serious an enemy as they turned out to be. Although, of course, there had been plenty of evidence in the previous 10 years, had we only been learning about it. So we set off from Cape Town and called in at the Maldives, which are, you know, now a gorgeous holiday spot. And I think we had to refuel there. There we were in a sort of beautiful lagoon, you know, great spot, very nice. Tropical kit, going through the Indian Ocean at night, you know, it was really, the war seemed a long way away until eventually we got to Singapore.
December 1941.
Yeah. And of course, there were a great deal of tuning going on the part of the Admiral. He went to see, I think, MacArthur, and he flew to MacArthur, and he flew back. And there was an air raid one night at which the Japanese came over and bombed the naval base where we were, but nothing was hit. Now, I should say that the trip, the Force Z, was set up by Churchill, as we know. And he put Admiral Phillips in charge. Now, the flagship of Force Z was going to be the Prince of Wales. And it was kitted out as a flagship with flag accommodation. Right? But the captain, of course, was still Captain Leach. And Captain Leach, you'll remember, had been captain of the Prince of Wales against the Bismarck, and Phillips wanted to court-martial him for breaking off the action. So it wasn't a very happy situation for Leach to have Admiral Phillips sent down in charge of in the same ship to be his admiral. They were not on the best of terms to start with, you can imagine. And, you know, this must have been pretty galling for Leach. But of course, only certain people, I suppose, realized this, but certainly I didn't, but it was pretty galling. But Phillips was very humorous and man, I suppose he suffered from being too damn small. He had to sort of assert himself, you see. But he was one of those who was brought up to believe that the only thing to have in the Navy is guns, you see, big guns. And there's no doubt that in the interwar years, the gunnery faction was in the ascendant. The fleet air arm were not. They had to fight for aircraft carriers, whereas, of course, the Americans and the Japanese had recognized the values of aircraft carriers long before we did. Fleet air arm was always starved, and Phillips was one of those who had no time for them. You see, he thought that there's nothing the fleet air arm can't do which a battleship with its guns can do better. So it was not a very happy situation. And then, as you know, we were due to meet with Repulse in Singapore, which we did, and with an aircraft carrier. But the aircraft carrier, which was due to come across from the east coast of the United States, ran on a rock and put itself out of action for 2 or 3 months while it had to get back into, I think it was Newport News, for repairs. So the aircraft carrier, which was due to meet us at Singapore and to be part of Force, a vital part of Force Z, was not there. So therefore, there was Phillips with no air cover whatever. The only air cover was in Singapore, where they had some Brewster Buffalo fighters, I think, a squadron to them. But again, they were grossly underprepared with, they'd been starved of fighter aircraft in Singapore. So the situation was being stacked up against the Force Z right from the start.
What did you see yourself of Singapore?
Oh, very little. First of all, you see, midshipmen were on 5 shillings a day. And out of that, you had to pay your mess bill, which usually came to about 2 and 6 or 3 shillings. So there wasn't a great deal left for riotous living. And I remember when we got to Singapore, we decided we ought to try to go into the town. So we got on a bus, and I think we pooled all our money. We had about 30 shillings between about 5 of us. And we got on a bus and got taken to the centre, and we found a rickshaw, and we piled into this, and we said to the boy, who, of course, was Chinese, we said, Raffles Square, that being the only place we ever heard of, you see. And he jogged off, and we were taken off through the streets, and it got seedier and seedier, and eventually stopped outside a place, and we realised it was a brothel. And we were all terrified, of course, we were 18, you know, we thought, goodness me, get back to Raffles Square. I don't remember seeing much. We probably treated ourselves to an ice cream, but we didn't have any money for any riotous living, certainly not, and certainly no inclination for brothels. Oh dear, how ridiculous.
What was the atmosphere like in Singapore?
Oh, terribly normal. Oh no, absolutely normal. You see, that nothing had been prepared. There was no defences up. Everything was absolutely normal. Nobody believed the Japanese could possibly be a threat. And of course, the naval base, as we know, was equipped with some heavy guns, but those are all pointing out to sea, and they couldn't be swiveled around as far to get to point up the peninsula, because it was held then, you see, that impossible for an army to come down through the peninsula. Though how people got to that conclusion, it's very interesting, because, I mean, there were roads, there was a railway. I mean, people went up through the peninsula. So, obviously the Japanese could, and they did on bicycles in large numbers. But that was thought to be impossible. Yeah. And the atmosphere in Singapore was absolutely normal.
Mm. What did you know about the purpose of the Z force?
Oh, we knew we had to. We knew we were going to take on the Japanese invasion forces, and we thought, as juniors, we thought it was going to be pretty well a walkover for us, you see, because these were only little Japanese. And but our senior, I mean Captain Leach, for one, was well aware of the size of the problem, and she was. And Captain Leach, his son, Henry Leach, who became Admiral of the Fleet before he died, you remember, he was a midshipman, I think, and the I think the Mauritius was a cruiser in Singapore at the time, and he met his father and had dinner with him, and his father said, you know, that he had serious forebodings, you see, and that was the last time Leach, young Leach, saw his father, who didn't survive. So I was I went down with fever. I was in the sick bay the night we left Singapore to go and find the Japanese. But we had action stations in the middle of the night, so I got myself out of that, of course, and just a sort of mild fever anyway, and took up my action station. Now here was the first occasion of two when I was very lucky to survive. My action station had been what's called Commander's Doggy. The commander and the captain and the navigator had at action stations had a midshipman appointed to be with them, really to act as a messenger or whatever. You see, you make yourself useful. And he was called the Captain's Doggy, or Commander's Doggy. And I had been given the job of Commander's Doggy. Now, the Commander's Action Station was in what was called the Lower Plot. The Lower Plot was about 10 decks down, right at the bottom of the ship, where right below the armor, where you could control the rudder, you'd have a compass, etc. You could control the ship quite blind, but you had communications with the rest of the ship. So if the upper works were shambles, you could still do something from down below. And that was the captain, that was the commander's action station, because if the captain got killed, the commander could take over. And a couple of days before the Singapore, the various jobs of action stations had been shifted round amongst the mids, and a young lad called Midshipman Tribe, was made Commander's Doggy, and I was put onto an Oerlikon. At Cape Town, we'd been fitted out with extra Oerlikon, about 1-inch diameter single-barreled guns, 1-inch bore, perhaps not as big as that, but they were fast firing heavy machine guns, really, for close range protection against aircraft. And several of these have been fitted on the upper works, where they had these guns on a pedestal, surrounded with a sort of a bit of steel around, like a big dustbin, as minor protection. Controlled by a gun layer who actually pointed and shot the thing, and a loader who provided the ammunition, and a midshipman behind them to direct them and say, you know, stop firing there, fire somewhere else.
Graham Allen, end of reel 3.